So this is part three
of
our interview with Tommy Keane.
It is.
Just a few days after his untimely passing. Mm-hmm. This is Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
It was so nice of Tommy to spend this time with us. It was really, really fun.
It was wonderful.
It was a much, you know, sort of looser setting.
Yeah.
We had dinner and drinks and interviewed him at a place called Villain and Saint.
Yeah, in his hometown.
You know, usually when we have these artist interviews, they're great. You know, they give us some time backstage, but, you know, you always feel like this pressure, like, you know, we got to do this within a certain window. This was not like that at all. So, like, as long as we want to hang out, you know?
We could have stayed there all night and talked. It was great, but we didn't. Yeah, it was really, really nice.
It was really fun. So he spent a lot of time with us, and we put together these three episodes for you. I think there's even some extra material that we might use somewhere down the road.
Jim, there is. There's some great stories about Tommy going to concerts and, you know, just his memories of rock and roll. Like we said at the top, you know, earlier in the week, his memory was photographic and incredible and just had funny insights about what, you know, an incredible experience in rock and roll.
So much so that what you're going to hear in this first segment here today is when he went on tour playing guitar for Paul Westerberg in the 90s, on a tour in the mid-90s. And I mentioned to him that I went to one of those shows in Cincinnati, I guess mid to late 90s. See, I can't even remember when it was exactly. I can just barely remember anything about it. He remembered everything about that specific show.
He knew exactly when it was.
He was like, that Cincinnati, Bogarts.
Yeah.
Here's the day, the date. What happened on stage.
Unbelievable.
You know,
the shoes he was wearing.
Unbelievable.
Incredible.
Yeah. So, usually, you know, again, usually that's not the case with musicians. All this stuff kind of runs together after a while. He remembered everything.
Yeah.
It was really a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's get into this section. He's going to talk about that tour and also
his work with Robert Pollard from Guided by Voices. Yeah, they made a collaboration album together.
All right, let's hear all this.
There's a period that we're kind of entering into here where you start playing with other people. And
right.
I've read a little bit where you felt like, hey, this is great. I can sort of be the side man. I can stand up there and be the guitar player, you know, and I think.
Love it.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about, you know, how that felt at that time and how you got into some of these, you know, sort of collaborations that you were doing. And, I mean, you played with Westerberg for a while. You played with a lot of people.
Well, it's funny. I went out and I played guitar on Tommy Stinson's record, the first Bash and Pop.
Yeah.
I played some guitar on it, and it's funny, the guy who produced that record, Don Smith, was one of Petty's main engineers. He'd done some Cracker records. He had some hits. There was this AC-30 in the studio. He said, that's Mike Campbell's AC-30. And he said, Mike just played all these guitars on Tommy's record. They're great. And he played me, and I was, wow, it's Mike Campbell. You know, just perfect. So what I did didn't make the record, which kind of pissed me off, but what Mike Campbell did also didn't make the record.
Oh, really?
So when it came out, I said, what happened, Tommy? He said, he said, just too pop.
Really?
What's the name of this band?
Pop's in the name, Tommy.
So anyway, at that time, Westerberg was in L.A. to promote the singles songs, Dyslexic Heart, and because that album came out, and his A&R guy who I knew for a long time, Michael Hill, came and said, I think we're going to do the Tonight Show and do one of these songs, because Paul didn't really have a band. And he said, and I think we want you to play guitar. I said, oh, great. Well, then when they put the band together for that tour, they got the guy Dave Minahan, you know, whatever. And but then I think for the 96 tour, once again, I'm in Toronto opening for the Gin Blossoms. I go down the street to buy some shoes, and I come back, and this is a long tour, about 25 shows. Our road manager said, man, Westerberg's here. He's looking for you. I said, really? Was he? So he came back after the set. He came back to the show, and he walked in. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I've got like 8 more shows. And he said, oh. He said, well, I got this drummer, this guy, and he played with Prince. He's amazing. And then I've got this bass player that's great too. And he said, he said, I'm at my wit's end. I cannot find a guitar player. And I've auditioned all these people in Minneapolis. And I was just thinking, oh, that's a drag, you know. But when I got home, there's all these messages in my answer machine. Tommy, help. Call me, call me, call me. So I called him and he said, why don't you fly out? We'll try it out. And I did. And
it worked out.
Then I did that
yep.
tour.
Yeah.
And how was that?
It was a lot of fun. It was great. We did Leno. We did Letterman. We did Gary Shandling. He's a difficult guy.
Paul.
Yep. His whole thing to me was, he said, right at the get-go, he said, you know, there's going to come a time, and this is kind of why I almost don't want you to do this, where I'm going to get mad and yell at you. He said, but don't take it personally. Okay, fine.
Hired you and then warned you that this is going to be the worst gig of your life and you shouldn't take it.
So
sounds pretty Paul Westerberg.
There's a lot of great stories here, but we don't need to go into all of them. But he'd move from person to person in the tour. He fired everyone but the bass player, who he couldn't stand, and the front house guy. His whole thing is, you're fired. It's like Trump, almost. Yeah. Lighting guy. You're fired!
That's right.
Fired one drummer on stage.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Had you ever seen that before? Were you on stage at the time? Well, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that before.
Well, this is a long story because the guy went crazy and stalked him.
Oh, no.
So we get to the end of the tour and we're down south and the places are not selling. So he's not in a good mood. And he is pissed off because I think at one point that song, Love Untold, yep. had a chance of being a hit.
Yeah.
They thought it was going to go, and it didn't. And he knew it was his last record for Warner Brothers, and he's just spending. Limo at the airport, first class. I'm sick of the bus. I'm flying. Limo waiting for me, 8 hours, you know.
Yeah.
So he then turned his attention to me. So we were in Houston.
I haven't picked on Tommy Keene all tour.
He hadn't. Yeah. So we're playing in Houston at this disco called Numbers.
Wow, that doesn't sound good.
There's 200 people in a 1,000-seat place. These two drunk guys in the back are going, Tommy Keene, please let her go. And I looked at him and he went,
shut those guys up.
He said, oh, you know Tommy, do you? You know what we call him? We call him the liquor puppet.
Oh, no.
You know, I can't drink, so no one else can. Then it got worse and worse and worse.
Oh, boy.
So
that's pretty hilarious.
His prophecy came true, though, right?
Well, there you go.
But I got a lot out of that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say.
You know what I mean? I mean, it really raised my profile a lot.
Okay.
And it was such a cred thing. You played with Paul Westerberg. Which, you know, he was the darling songwriter of his generation. So I got it really helped me out a lot. All of a sudden, I was cool again.
And did you learn anything from that, too?
What exactly?
I don't know. Anything about...
It was interesting, you know, riding on tour buses and staying in Ritz-Carlton's and seeing that side of it and seeing really what happens when... The labels work in the record, and it doesn't happen. And it all just sort of slides down at the end, and everyone's upset. And, you know, he went off the rails after that. He just, you know, he called me up, and he's like, I don't know what to do with myself. You know, that was a big blow to him.
Yeah.
Because he thought, finally.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, it was sort of how the other side is.
Yeah, certainly.
Traveling at that level, playing to, you know, two nights Irving Plaza, Winona Ryder's here, and what's her name, the blonde from the Ben Stiller movie.
Oh, yeah. Cameron Diaz.
Cameron Diaz,
yeah.
And, you know, all these people coming out, like, because he's it. It was very enlightening to see how the other half lives, not be crammed in a van playing some crappy punk rock club.
Did you get any songs out of that?
I probably did.
Yeah.
Well, I asked him. I wanted him to write lyrics for me because that's his thing, right?
Right. Everyone,
the clever, the turnaround of, yes.
Yep.
And he said, oh, yeah, great. So I sent him these two songs, and which both ended up on Isolation Party. And there was a song called Twilight's in Town, and I hadn't written the lyrics, and he went crazy over the music, and he said, okay, we got something here. This is it, man. This is it. And it was a song about Montgomery Clift, because he'd always call me Monty for whatever reason. And I have the only copy of that.
Is that right?
Someday I'll unleash it.
Contrast that to say, what you recently did with Robert Pollard from Guided by Voices.
That was kind of the next thing. And then I did it, waited around for a while, did a record in 02 that I really don't like, called The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down. And I got my old manager and I were, he was getting out of the business, and he set me up this deal with this label, Spin Art. And these people, they were sort of folding, and they never even ended up paying me mechanicals.
Oh, wow.
And my brother, who's a lawyer, said, you know, you can take them to court. It's going to cost you $6,000. They owe you $2,700.
Right.
Forget about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And that really bummed me out. And then I get a call from a friend of mine who's a writer in Chicago, and he said, I just interviewed Bob Pollard. And I knew he was a fan.
Yeah.
Because I'd read him talking about me. And I suggested to him that you and him should do a record together. And he said, yes. So I called him. We talked. And we opened for Guided by Voices a couple times in 03.
Mm-hmm.
Just San Francisco and L.A. And I started working on a whole bunch of things. And I sent him a bunch of things. And then he called me and he said, I have to put this on hold because I'm breaking up Guided by Voices. We're doing a farewell tour.
Right, yeah.
04, the electrifying conclusion. And you guys, we're going to give you some shows. We did Boston, Philly, D.C., did San Diego, did the Fillmore in San Francisco. So that, I sent him a bunch of stuff, and that record got moved back. It didn't, came out right when 06, Crashing the Ether came out. Sort of was a bad timing, but that's when he wanted to put it out.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting experience, because he collaborated.
I would imagine.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
he's really
good at that. When you listen to
it,
it feels like that.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
He's got nothing but songs in him, right?
Yeah.
And song titles.
Right.
Oh, I would imagine.
He's not going to hold back because he's like, I got more after that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So I sent him about 30 things from full on. By this point, I had a studio in my house and I was recording my own records. I sent him full on drums down to just like guitar playing along to a whatever. One of those. So he told me, I'm going to take these 12. And they all had kind of stupid titles, like Thing in F Sharp.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know. Just so I could tell what he was talking about. And he said, and this song, this song, this song, this song, this song. And I thought, he skipped some real obvious things that I thought were could be really good.
Interesting.
And when he
yeah.
said this one thing in F Sharp, I was like, God, you're kidding. You know, to me, it was bottom of the barrel. Well, that turned out to be the best song on the record. It's called Death of the Party. And out of nowhere, he came up with this amazing melody line and these amazing lyrics. He just shined it up.
She used to be an American airline. Two hotels, parallels of the far out moon. Still being watched by the pipe smoke contingent, yeah. From creameries, extremeries, and you won't leave soon. She drives like an Exodus snow to the steeple, and her touch is sad. The cold room is clean and it's distant from people.
All right, we'll take a little break here,
yeah.
And then you're going to hear more from Tommy Keane. And while we're taking this break, let's just mention that if you're new to the show,
mm-hmm.
we hope you like the show. It's not always this somber, but the way you can get the show every day is to subscribe on Apple Podcasts / iTunes and just hit that little subscribe button. It comes to you every day, right?
Yeah, it's pretty easy.
Do that. Also, you might want to visit our website where we have more about Tommy Keane
mm-hmm.
and other stuffs that we have talked about.
That's right. Suburbspod.com.
So do those two things.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get back to the interview with Tommy Keane. In this section. Oh, this is really good stuff. I don't know that we really even need to set this up too much.
It's, I think it explains it.
Sort of bringing the whole career story to a conclusion.
Yeah.
Why have you never made like the Tommy Keane electronica record or the Tommy Keane, you know, all keyboard record or the Tommy Keane African record? Like, why is...
Because I've thought about that so often.
Have you?
Why don't I do this? And then I think, well, the few people that like me will go, I don't want that. I got so-and-so if I want that. So I'm torn because I think it's a little self-indulgent.
Maybe.
If someone came to me and said, will you do an album like this? I'd do it, but, you know.
But that's not necessarily a desire that's within you to...
I just know a lot of people would bitch, like, what is this? I want that.
But like Tommy Stinson, we were talking about earlier, right? Like,
right.
He's gone in sort of a bit of a country direction with a lot of his stuff,
yeah.
You know? And I think it's maybe just the way he wants to go, right? It's the kind of music that's inspiring him now. I mean, do you ever have that feeling of just like... I mean, is there something you feel like you have... some interest that you have that maybe the fans wouldn't think of that you want to explore a little bit?
Well, the last couple of records, I've had a couple of instrumentals. And at one point, I was toying with an idea of doing a whole instrumental record like that. But then again, I thought, well, who would buy that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you like those songs on those records, you'd like it.
Yeah.
It's almost like doing a soundtrack to a movie, basically.
Well, that's what I was saying. Maybe it could get in movies then.
That is, man, let me tell you.
Well, songs
that's
from
the toughest
film.
Thing yeah. in Los Angeles. There are
really?
Millions of dudes sitting there, I want to do soundtracks. No, the two, I get asked this, what mistakes have you made? And if you could go back and undo them, there are two very crucial things that I did wrong, or I was misguided, or people told me to do this or do that. Because I was surrounded by a bunch of people, the manager, the lawyer, the band members, the friends, the, you know, you should do this, you should do that, do this, do that, do that. And it got really crazy. So what we didn't go over was that in between the Dauphin EP, Places That Are Gone, and the Geffen record,
mm-hmm.
Dauphin put me in the studio in Charlotte, North Carolina, at Reflection, to do an album. So they said, oh, here's the EP, introduce you.
Yeah.
And now we want to do a full-length album. And the guy, Don Dixon, was on board.
Oh, yeah.
From the get-go. And then they said, oh, we want more of a name with Don. Don had done the two R.E.M. records with Mitch Easter.
Right, right. Reckoning, yeah.
And he just finished the Guadalcanal Diary record. It hadn't come out yet. So first they said Marshall Crenshaw. And they went to Marshall Crenshaw's manager, and he wanted too much money. So then they said, and I think Ted or I came up with this, what about T-Bone Burnett? And they got in touch with him, and he heard the tapes. He said, yeah. So we spent a month, and we did a record that was going to be called Songs from the Film.
Yeah, wow.
In the interim, Geffen came along and got all... And then they heard some of it, and they said, if you put this record out, the deal is off.
Really?
And so this is mid-84. You think I'd been chasing this holy grail major label deal since I joined Raz in 78. So that's 6 years. It's a long time when you're that young. And you think, this might never happen
right.
again.
And here it is.
I better do what they say. So the people at Dauphin were freaked out. And then they worked something out where Dauphin got a cut of this and that. But we had this base of College Radio, and the next logical step was to put this record produced by Don and T-Bone Burnett out. We didn't, which resulted in a 2-year gap of nothing coming out. So whatever momentum we had, a lot of it was shot. The other thing they said after hanging out with him, fire your manager. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. We won't work with this guy. And we signed the deal in spring of 85. Now we're at January 86. The album's coming out February 22nd. And they're telling me, you got to fire this guy. It's going to be, if you don't, we can't guarantee what will happen. Everyone said, fire him, fire him, fire him. And it was me, the holdout. I said, no, this guy is stuck with me, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of the day, it's like, shut up, everyone. Okay, I fired him. He went crazy. He said, I get you to the Super Bowl, and the night before, you fire me, which was kind of true.
Yeah.
And they just didn't, they wanted a pushover. They didn't want someone that was going to say, no, he shouldn't do this. He should do this. They didn't want to hear from anyone. They were overindulgent, meddling. Ted said they treated us like, they acted like Nazis around us. And I did it, and it really hurt me. The album came out, I had no manager.
Right.
Then I was managed by this guy, Tim Collins, who managed Aerosmith for 2 months. He saw what the A&R people were doing. He said, I can't deal with this.
You can't deal with it, right.
I'm out.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I ended up with this woman, Linda Clark, who managed Violent Femmes and Los Lobos. And yeah, whatever. That didn't work out. So two things. There you go.
Yeah. And but like you said, I think, you know, in that climate and in that time, and that 6 years must have felt, I mean, you said the year and a half you were in Raz felt like 6 years. So it must have felt like your whole career at
that point
was on the line.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, like someone said Clive Davis was interested from Arista. I didn't really see any of that. It was the talk. And I remember the guy from Capitol coming to see me. And he was the president of Capitol Records. We're opening for someone at the Ritz in New York, like Modern English in 84. And he said, you've got kind of one of those voices. You either love it or you hate it. And I said, oh, like Dylan. He said, yeah. Well, that's... I guess he hated it. But he's honest.
Yeah.
Right? You know?
And you didn't have the right shoes on that night.
Right.
There's more material than we included here over these
absolutely.
3 days, but this was a nice sort of arc
really nice.
Of the mm-hmm. story yeah. of Tommy Keane. So we hope that people enjoyed it.
Yes, and we'd love to hear from you about anything you remember about Tommy, his music, his career, or if you saw him or interacted with him. I'm sure a lot of people did. So maybe people saw him when he opened for Matthew Sweet. Who knows?
It'd be great to hear. So ways you can do that, we would love it if you would call our phone line,
612-440-1984.
And then you can leave a message there, and then we can actually put your voice on an upcoming episode. We'll be happy to do that.
Please call us.
You can also email us if you'd prefer that. It's rock@suburbspod.com. We mentioned before, that's also our website, suburbspod.com, mm-hmm. where you can read about the show and listen to the show there if you prefer. And another way to get in touch with us is through Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, all three of those at suburbspod.
Yeah.
So please do that. And with that, I guess all we can say is rest in power.
Yeah, right? That's all we can say. Rest in power, Tommy Keane.
All right. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you guys later. Yeah, this Saturday night, will I see
We're going to continue to revisit some of the anecdotes and just little stories that Tommy told us when we talked to him, you know, both to honor his legacy and just because they're really entertaining. Yeah. So, you know, as we go through, you know, the months ahead, there might be a day where we're like, hey, it's Tommy Keene Day.